You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This is Julie Atherton, author of B2B Social Selling, Connect with Customers, Build Relationships and Drive Sales. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Julie Atherton to talk about her book, B2B Social Selling Strategy, Connect with Customers, Build Relationships, and Drive Sales, published by Kogan Page. Julie is the founder of the social media transformation advisory and marketing consultancy, Small Wonder. A business leader, public speaker, consultant, and strategist with over 30 years of experience, she specializes in training and advising organizations from global brands to educational organizations and social enterprises on how to embed social media in their strategic development and growth. Having worked both agency and client side, she has a wealth of knowledge on delivering marketing, brand, and business strategy across almost every sector. She is also the author of Social Media Strategy, a practical guide to social media marketing and customer engagement, which was featured quite recently on episode 477 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Her books are widely used by PR, marketing, and sales professionals and universities. And interesting fact, she is not the Julie Atherton, who is the British actress, singer, and director. Julie, congratulations on B2B Social Selling Strategy, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome back, friend. I knew this day would come.
Nice to be back.
So, it's great to have you back. Julie, are you often confused with the other Julie Atherton?
Well, I haven't ever had anybody who asked me if I was her.
Do her Amazon packages show up at your house, things like that?
Well, no, but she always ranks much higher than me. You know, if you Google my name and everything, it's very disappointing, really.
Yeah. Now, you're not related to her, are you?
Famous. No. But my brother is called Mike Atherton, and he's not related to the cricketer either.
Oh, okay. Wow. I think I know the
very
right...
famous Michael Atherton, who's an English cricketer.
Okay.
But my brother isn't related to him or him either. So, you know.
But it sounds like you and your brother probably get a lot of half-price drinks, just by saying your name.
If only.
So you were on episode 477, as I mentioned, and this will be episode 481. So thank you for your willingness to return so quickly and, you know, putting your reputation at risk. But I am an unabashed Julie Atherton fan. Obviously, I mean that in all sincerity. I like the way you write books and you field your own research. You cite a lot of other folks. But more importantly, there's a certain clarity in your writing. I don't know if anyone's ever told you that, but it's very, very clear, it paced very well and very logical. So,
thank you very much.
Please don't stop writing these books.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I really appreciate the feedback. That's really kind.
So, longtime Marketing Book Podcast listener and ridiculously good looking guy, Ryan Anderson, who lives in Oxford, Mississippi. I'm kidding. He lives in Oxford, England.
Oh, behave.
When he learned that you were returning to the show, he was very quick to ask if Julie Atherton might be the winner of the quickest returning author on the Marketing Book podcast. And Julie Atherton, I'm pleased to announce that you are. Congratulations.
Oh, I'm so honored.
Yes.
It's, you know, a real privilege.
Yes.
Oh, I can't actually believe it. I'm very moved. Thank you.
Well, that record has been held since 2015 by the best-selling author Dori Clark, when she was on episode 7, and then she came back for episode 15 for her books Reinventing You and Stand Out. Now, if Dori Clark were here...
She's going to be sad now.
Well, if Dori were here, she would say, "Don't cry for me, Argentina," because she's been back at an additional 2 times. So she is in the Marketing Book Podcast 4-Timers Club. So she's doing just great. So,
good.
Yeah.
Something for me to aspire to then.
Yes. And once you're on the Marketing Book Podcast 3-Timers, you then join the Marketing Book Podcast 3-Timers Club. And that gets you a lot of secret benefits that I'm not free to divulge. But one thing I can tell you is that you will, for the rest of your life, pay a lot less at Taco Bell because you will get a lifetime supply of discount coupons. I mean, the benefits of being on this show are just really tremendous. So, how have you been since we last spoke? I'm kidding. But, I have actually had another book on the show about social selling from your same publisher, Kogan Page, about a year or two ago, Tim Hughes.
Yeah.
He wrote,
that's a great book, actually.
Yeah, he wrote Social Selling, Techniques to Influence Buyers and Change Makers. It was the second edition. And I'll include a link to that interview on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And Tim lives in the London suburb of Teddington. Have you ever met him?
No, I've never met him, but we have kind of corresponded. Is that what you call it? We commented on each other's stuff on LinkedIn and maybe really appreciate each other's work, I think.
But, oh.
Yeah, we haven't actually met.
Well, I should introduce the two of you, you know, because I'm a uniter, not a divider, Julie. And I think you all would certainly enjoy meeting each other. And just in, I don't know if you're interested in this, but he has a vast collection of vinyl records.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
Very good.
And he's yet another good-looking Marketing Book Podcast listener. So, Tim, if you're listening to this, I'm sending good vibes your way. So, let me just mention one thing. There's always a first-time listener on every episode, and they may be thinking, this is the Marketing Book Podcast. Why is there a book on sales? Well, there have been a lot of books on sales on the Marketing Book Podcast. There have been about, over 70 now. And if anyone would like a PDF with the links to every one of those episodes, please let me know and I'll send it to you. I update it all the time. I'll be adding this to it. But the reason why is because the most successful marketers are the ones that have the deep understanding of sales, what the salespeople are doing, what their challenges are, and even more importantly, understanding the buying, the what's on the mind of the customer. And otherwise, those that are just doing marketing activity, whatever that is, off in some cubicle in the corner, you have a lot less job security if you don't understand how your business can grow, and sales is a big part of that. So I want to read from two places in the foreword by Stephen Walsh. And he is the co-founder of Anders Pink and author of Selling is Sharing. So he wrote, speaking of selling and salespeople, "The best sales professionals I have had the privilege to work with are first and foremost great learners. They are hungry for insights. They stay on top of developments in their sector, and they're passionate about helping people by sharing those insights." And then he goes on to talk about LinkedIn defines social selling as leveraging your social network to find the right prospects, build trusted relationships, and ultimately achieve your sales goals. It's those three words in the middle that are so often skipped over in the rush to achieve sales goals. Building trust requires patience and humility. It can only be earned at the pace our prospects will allow. We have all been on the receiving end of a seemingly helpful outreach on a social network that quickly turned into a sales pitch. No trust is earned, no relationship is built, no sales goal is achieved. What Julie shows us in this considered and practical addition to the field is how to put trust at the center of our social selling endeavors. And then at the introduction, you write, "This book is an essential read for everyone involved in B2B marketing and sales who wants to embrace social media transformation and improve their B2B Results. It provides a simple and structured approach for all practitioners in the industry or anyone studying for digital marketing or sales qualifications. Aiming to both inspire and educate about the benefits of a strategic approach to social selling, it will guide you in generating and nurturing relationships to create strong leads in the sales, whatever field your business operates within. And then finally, on the next page, you write, social media, when deployed strategically and effectively, offers a uniquely personal long-term networking opportunity for sales teams and business professionals. For many, this has supercharged their sales performance with empowered teams, faster results, and higher revenues. For others, the challenges of navigating social channels for business can be daunting. Concerns over social media confidence, personal and professional conflicts of interest, and a loss of management control can lead to a lack of action or just plain dull and ineffective modes of engagement. And jumping to the very end of the book on page 211, you write about the impact of social selling. 78% of salespeople engaged in social selling outsell their peers. That was a head slap. I was amazed.
Yeah, it is incredible, actually, the impact that it can have, and surprising how many people aren't doing it very consideredly or strategically. They're just kind of dabbling, or they're really being very pushy and aggressive and using techniques that they wouldn't use in normal sales techniques because they feel unconfident in the area.
Yeah. And newsflash for those listening who may be some of the folks you were just starting to describe, social selling is not wasting time on social media when you should be speaking to prospects. So let's just jump into it. You posed this question at the beginning of the book. What is social selling and why does it work so well?
Yeah, so I think it's a bit like Stephen said. You know, I really agree with him. It's about building a long-term relationship, a one-to-one professional relationship for sales teams or business development people. And it's doing that in a way that isn't necessarily expecting anything back straight away. You're actually there to build that relationship and to build that trust, because effectively you're not going to sell your multi-million pound IT system or even relatively small B2B sales over a social media post. But you have an opportunity to create these connections that will last, you know, as people move jobs, you're still going to be connected to them. As they seek out information, you'll be there to support and provide that. And you are enabling this dialogue, which ultimately does build trust, builds those relationships, and then acts, you know, to support all those other channels that you're using within that sales process. So it's very powerful, ungatekept. You know, there's no, you know, nobody's checking your social media feed like in the way they might be your telephone calls or your emails for you. So, you know, you've got real one-to-one dialogue with those decision makers, and that's really impactful.
Yes, there are a couple of things from the book that I wanted to quote as it related to that. One was from Kim Watts, the lecturer at the University of Bath and a B2B consultant.
Yeah.
University of Bath, isn't that where you got your MBA?
It is.
Yeah. So she had a great, you were talking about, what was it? You know, the certain things don't happen on social media. And she, this is on page 67. She wrote in her interview, she said, no one bought a train from a tweet. No one spent £2 million from a post. Salespeople should only get involved when the level of risk is high enough that the buyer can't make the decision on their own. They need to speak to someone to know more. It's when that level of discomfort comes into place where the person is out of their depth, so they need someone to consult with you, a salesperson. Sales done well is about how you can inform, educate, and support your buyers to make their choice, and social selling enables you to build strong individual relationships with your network to facilitate this. And actually, a little bit later in the book, you write, social doesn't work alone. You may use social media to find new buyers, or they may reach out to you because of your profile and their network. However, you will still need to use other channels such as face-to-face and virtual networking and meetings, phone, text, email, LinkedIn, in-mail to continue and support the buyer's journey. So I just wanted to kind of disabuse folks of that, that of what's involved here. One thing I want to ask, you write that although the core responsibility for social selling is with marketing, sales, business development teams, the wider organization has a role to play in ensuring success. Can you talk about how the B2B social selling integrates with the wider sales and marketing mix?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you asked that because of when you introduced the podcast, you said, "Oh, it's why are we talking about sales when on the marketing podcast?" Well, I think the answer to that question is the same as the answer to this other question that you just asked me, which is actually social selling is a pure integration of marketing and sales. The insights that come out of the sales team should be feeding the spine of marketing content that you're creating within the marketing team. And the sales team should be using that content effectively to build their relationships. And there should be a synergy between the marketing content that's coming out from that marketing team and all those individual sales or business development people working with that, but also coalescing with each other to get the maximum impact. Because what you're trying to do is make sure that the brand that you represent, the business that you represent, has the highest level of visibility and credibility and authority in the area of expertise that you have. So therefore, you've got to have content pillars that go across the organization and that everyone supports through the things that they do. And those individual sales teams need to be able to demonstrate their own individual expertise within the context of what the organization delivers.
Yes. And the thing that's so interesting is that it almost might trick an organization into getting sales and marketing working more closely together. We're not about tricking folks, but it's just one more thing that helps them work together better and encourages them to do so.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the case studies within the book, so there's Marlene Lydon from SAP, and there's Anita from Ericsson. They both talk about this culture that needs to change within the organization in order to make it effective. You need to have buy-in from senior leadership within marketing teams and sales teams, and you need to support that with the content and the training and the guidance that you want to do to get to deliver it. Otherwise, you've got a very disparate kind of group of people who either feel afraid to comment and post and produce content, or maybe go a bit rogue and are just talking about random stuff that isn't necessarily as relevant to the organization as you need it to be.
Yes. And so much of what's in your book applies to all kinds of marketing content. And I want to ask you about this, and I know this may sound obvious, but in chapter 2, you write about connecting the buyer's goals with the seller's goals. Now, sadly, too many sellers are aware of only their own goals. So explain what you mean by a buyer's goals, because if sellers and marketers would just give a little bit of thought to this, it would be enormously helpful, because the buyer's goals are much deeper and on a more emotional basis.
Yeah, and I think this is one of my kind of pet sort of beliefs, I suppose, is that actually buying something is quite nerve-wracking for people, and that happens in B2C, but generally in B2C, the ticket price and the time it's taken to make that decision has been much shorter, and the impact of getting it wrong is much less. But in B2B, your reputation's on the line if you make the wrong decision. You could, really make it at work. It could really affect how people see you at work, and perhaps even affect how your potential career prospects at work. So people really are very nervous about making the wrong decision. You know, hence you get those kind of, you know, old phrases like nobody ever got fired for buying IBM, mm-hmm. you know, whereas, but actually that might not be the best solution for you in those circumstances. So what we want to do as sellers is we want to help people feel really confident that they're making the right decision. And so by looking at this buyer's journey, and thinking about what their goals are at each of these different stages, we're understanding the issues that they're facing. And so rather than saying buy now, buy now, buy now, what we're actually doing is helping them move through those stages confidently, having addressed the problems, which might be what is my, you know, the first stage is actually what is the problem. And most of the time, the best sellers will get involved at that problem identification stage and be helping the buyer actually crystallize what their problem really is so that they have a greater understanding of what the solution might be. Because, you know, the one of the issues is if we move too fast through this process and actually end up buying something that isn't really going to do the job that we need because we didn't do that rigor at the beginning. And that patience, that support, that intuition is really, really important, I think. And the best sellers just have that naturally when they're face to face, when they're meeting with people, when they're in these virtual conversations, but in social media, how do you have that sensitivity? How do you demonstrate that through these channels? And that's what social selling's about.
Well, in a later chapter, I get back to Kim Watts. She mentions two modes that people are always in at work. I just love the way this is explained. Yeah. Self-promotion or self-preservation. Explain yeah. the difference there and who tends to be in which camp.
So Kim, she's worked with huge organizations and many, many different types of organizations and sales teams in particular within those organizations. And her view is that, you know, at certain stages of your career, you are really keen to be promoting yourself because you know, you're ready for the next challenge. You want to, maybe you want a promotion or maybe you want to move jobs or you're just eager to succeed. And that might be, you know, when you're early stage in your job, or it may be later on, but when you're wanting to move up different levels. And then there are other times in your job where you are like, I really need to, you know, I'm not bothered about maybe being promoted, or in fact, I perhaps don't want to be noticed too much in case anyone wants a head cut, you know, there might be some redundancies or something coming up. Or maybe I've just had a baby and I'm not getting loads of sleep and, you know, my kids mm-hmm. are really at a difficult age. So there'll be different times in your lives. My cats are just about to jump off the...
So. Oh, this is an animal-friendly podcast. And yeah. also, is Lionel, your Bedlington Terrier, there?
He's there, and he's just looking at them, but the cats are just looking. Yeah, I've got two cats as well, Gregor and Trev. So, yeah, so this, you know, so and when you're later in your career or at a time in your career where it's not convenient for you to really want to be, you know, putting your head above the parapet, then you're very quiet, you know, in self-promotion. You're not really going to be promoting yourself so much. And therefore, you might be very passive within these social channels. But I would still argue whether you're promoting yourself or not, you are still observing what's going on and absorbing information, and you may still use content that you see within those environments to help you do your job better, but you might not be actively engaging with that content and shouting about it because you're not necessarily that bothered whether anyone sees you promoting yourself.
Yeah, it also mentioned that the self-preservation mode people are less visible in social media and are often missed digitally. And she said that the higher up people are in their careers, the more likely they are to be risk-averse decision makers. There was a book on the show last year called The Jolt Effect by Matt Dixon, and it's all this new research that talked about just how terrified people are to make a purchase decision. In fact, even when they know they have to make a decision for their organization, making the wrong decision is is worse than no decision at all.
Yeah, I think so. And I think this is why I think social selling is a really powerful tool, though, because we are, particularly in B2B, we often don't make that decision alone. We make that with a group of individuals. So if we're really good at social selling within our network, we will have identified that buyer group and the different roles that they have. And we will ideally be connected with all of them, and we'll be serving relevant content for them and talking, having relevant conversations with them around the same subject area, but not necessarily exactly the same points that we're making or the same conversations. But what that allows is a very soft way of, when you're outside of meetings, outside of those formal those formal connections, to have informal sharing of knowledge and sharing of interesting information that all of those people in that buyer group will see, and will be raising the profile of you as a seller and your organization within the minds of all of them. So everyone's familiar with you, everyone knows that you've got a great reputation in this area, everyone's had some kind of useful content from you, and they can dip in and dip out of that as much at their will in social. They're not pressured into having to open an email and reply to you, and they're not feeling bombarded by phone calls or chasing emails. And therefore, actually, you've got a really soft way of still having quite a big impact on that buying group and helping them, exactly as you say, overcome that fear of that buying decision.
Yes. And there's a different framework. In other words, a different way of looking at how all this is. And you, in the book, you talk about, like, these are some of the traditional approaches and certain things need to be looked at from a different angle. And you write that, page 78, social media has changed the relationship between consumers, buyers, and brands. And in B2B, it has also changed our relationship with the businesses we work for and the buyers they sell to. Can you explain this concept of the interdependent brand?
Yeah, so I kind of was exploring this and was thinking, well, what is it that's happened with social media in terms of the power that a brand has in its relationship with its consumers? And I'd also be, I can't remember why I'd been reading about relationship theory, but I've been reading the stuff about relationship theory, probably as something to do with my MBA, actually, while I was doing my MBA. And I thought it's actually, there's quite a close parallel between the way that we have negative relationships, so codependent relationships, which are very controlled relationships where somebody's, you know, had the power balance is very imbalanced. And, you know, we're afraid of change, we're seeking approval, all of those kind of things that are going on in those codependent relationships. And often brands that are scared of social media have a very controlling behavior in the way that their content is used, and they're very controlling of the people, the salespeople within their organizations, about what they can and can't do. And they, you know, maybe have to approve posts and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which is really limiting about how you get your personality out there, and also doesn't really inspire much confidence in the individuals to have a go at it. And so I thought that was kind of like where a lot of organizations who are fearful of this space are. And then the interdependent relationship is a really positive relationship where you actively listen to what, you know, people are saying. You've got really clear boundaries about what you think is right and wrong, and you're prepared to stand up for that. You communicate, you know, regularly and clearly, and you're really open and approachable to people. And I thought that's really what's going on with businesses that are embracing social media for social selling and feel confident in this space. They're empowering their teams to go out there and use this tool in a way that works for them. And they're giving them the support and the confidence to be able to do that. But they're not really micromanaging what they say or when they say it and how they say it, as long as those individuals understand, you know, what the brand stands for and where we're trying to go, and they behave within that loose framework, it's fine. And I think that's a really confidence building space to be in, but also really, really effective if you work that way.
Evidently, yes. So related to that, why is a seller's personal brand so important in B2B social selling? And I got to believe it's more important than a lot of sellers and organizations realize.
Yeah. So I think we need to, because social media is a conversational tool, it's a dialogue channel, they're dialogue channels. What we want to do is we want to demonstrate our personality within there. And we also need to demonstrate as sellers, not that we're brilliant at selling, but actually that we're bringing expertise into the decision making that you're going to make as an individual who's a buyer. And therefore, if you can identify as a salesperson where your expertise lies and what your personality, obviously you know what your personality is, but how you're going to represent your personality within your social channels, then you have an opportunity to give a reason why somebody might want to follow you, but also to have to demonstrate the reason why somebody would buy from you, which isn't that I'm going to give you loads of discounts or I'm brilliant, I'm a great sales guy, but actually because I've got this expertise that I'm bringing to help you make the right decision. And that's where the personal brand comes in, deciding what it is that you're going to stand for, which sits alongside your organizational expertise and is part of that, you know, adds to that organization expertise, which is demonstrated through the marketing. And you know, you might have a subject matter expert or a thought leader within your business who talks about something, and then you as a salesperson might also have an area of expertise that you have, and you'll focus on that rather than every single thing that your business does. You'll focus on that and the expertise you bring to add value.
Yes. And so the listener knows there's a big section about how to get all these things aligned from an organizational standpoint. Hopefully they're somewhat aligned, but what it is the organization needs to focus on, and then what the individual salespeople can be talking about.
And just to come in there as well, Douglas, you know, it has to be about you as well, because you might not stay with the same organization forever. So, but you'll still have those, that expertise is still going to be valuable to organization A, B, or C. So the reality is, you know, it does need to be about your personal brand. You might be sharing and talking about content that's produced by the organization you work for at the moment, but you'll be bringing that your expertise, your personal insights into that. Then, you know, if you move to another organization, you can still do the same thing and keep your followers and keep those personal connections, because you'll want to do that because that's part of your black book for as a salesperson.
Yeah, you're not gonna most of these, you know, folks aren't gonna jump to a different SIC code they're selling for.
yeah, exactly. And you know, that is part of, you know, there's a real benefit to growing that brand for yourself, so that when you want to move jobs, you are more attractive as a salesperson. And the best companies are the ones that say, yeah, we're investing in you, building your personal brand alongside our business, because
yes,
we know that's going to bring benefit to our business. You may leave, but it's our responsibility to make this the best company that you want to stay with. You may leave and you take, you know, your contacts with you. You need to build some contingency in there as an organization, you know, multiple people having relationships with key buyers. But the risk is much higher by not building those personal brands for those individuals than it is by, you know, them leaving and taking people with them.
Yes, I had to chuckle. Years ago, I had a client, and they would train all their folks, not just the technicians and all their people, but not just the salespeople.
Yeah.
And this guy's, it was a HVAC company, air conditioning, heating, you know, consumer-oriented. And his competitors will always say, why do you invest so much in training all your people? What happens if they leave? And he would always say, well, what happens if they stay?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they did quite well for themselves. So I want to jump to something else that might surprise folks that's in here, but I found it very refreshing, and I think it's going to, I don't know, maybe upset some folks, ruffle some feathers, as they might say. It's in chapter 6. And it's in, I'm looking at page 123, where you write about Benet and Fields, whom I've read about in a number of books, their analysis of marketing effectiveness on the long-term success of brands. And you write that in B2B, I believe Benet and Fields were more consumer-oriented, but you write in B2B, the term demand generation is usually used to describe the brand-building activity where you ensure organizations are aware of you and they're interested in your content, you know, what you offer, and that you're building trust. Sales activation is sometimes referred to as lead generation or lead activation. Okay, so I believe it was the IPA, Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, found that running both brand-building and sales activation campaigns together for B2B was 6 times as effective as running acquisition campaigns alone.
Yeah.
So talk about what the implications are of this for B2B social selling.
Well, I think there was some recent research on LinkedIn which said that only 20% of people on LinkedIn are in market at any one time, and yet something like 60 to 70% of the content on LinkedIn was sales activation content. So it's this disconnect, isn't it, between the buyer's journey and that seller's pathway, in that this journey takes quite a long time and the buyers have got a whole load of other stuff going on, and they're also trying to manage internal relationships and internal decision making to get an agreement around something that they perhaps really, really want to do, but it isn't going to be able to happen instantly. And so what happens in not great sales is, you know, the end of the month focus, that kind of push, push, push mentality overshadows the relationship building. And the risk is that what you lose is trust, and you lose the desire for somebody to want to work with you. You know, we've all probably experienced a really bad sales process and think, actually, I might have to work with this person now if I buy this. I'm definitely not getting it, even if it seems really good, because I don't really like the way that they've, and also that the culture of the organization has been misrepresented by that overly pushy kind of experience. So I think we need to be really useful in social selling. We need to be really supportive. We need to, you know, we're not making the sale via this channel. So we need to build this extra sort of comfort in the relationship. And with that comes a much more likelihood to buy.
Yes. Put a pin in it, as they say on page 125. You're right. If you focus your content or campaign solely on sales activation, you will risk ignoring the needs of most of your connections and followers. So there's, just so folks will know, there's an entire chapter on tools, B2B social selling tools, and everybody loves tools. And the appendix lists many other tools to learn about. And obviously in that chapter, you do talk about LinkedIn, plays a big role in B2B selling to varying degrees. And something your book, as well as several other of the sales books that have been on the show, mentioned is that your LinkedIn profile should be set up for a customer, not a recruiter. Explain the mistake that a lot of people make in that regard.
Yeah, so a lot of people will put on their, particularly salespeople, will put on their LinkedIn profile how good they are at sales. So, you know, there'll be the volume of revenue that they've generated. It might be all the different, all their connections might be, other kind of sales, but a lot of other salespeople within their connections. But really what they need to be putting in that profile is the way that, as I talked about earlier, how they've supported and helped people make the right decisions, having testimonials from those people within their profile, making sure the keywords are not about being a great salesperson, but actually about the problems and the issues that are interesting to their buyers, so that their buyers see that resonance between this individual and them, rather than when you read about them, it's just all about how brilliant they are at making a sale, which actually is not relevant to a buyer. They don't care about that. They care about, do you know what my problem is and can you help me with that?
Right. And also telegraphs that the seller has commission breath. or they're more focused on their goals than their sellers. Yeah. But otherwise, there are a lot of them that look like, I'm a quota-crushing B2B sales bro.
Exactly. And you wouldn't say that if you went to a meeting with somebody. You're not going to say that when you walk into the meeting and introduce yourself. So why would you say that on your LinkedIn profile? Obviously, if you're looking for a new job, maybe you might switch it up and change it. But if you're working for an organization, you want it to work for the job that you're doing at the moment, it really needs to be focused on the customer.
So all you sales folks, take a look today. And I'll tell you something else. It doesn't have to be perfect, but just start thinking about it. Maybe change a word or two. Put it more in customer language than in recruiter language.
And you can check as well. There's loads of tools within LinkedIn to see, what are you being found for in search? Are you being found for, the types of expertise that you've got in the area that your customers care about? Or are you being found by loads of recruiters looking for a salesperson? You can see what you're coming up for in search and who's finding you and all of those kind of things. It's really easy on LinkedIn to manage that and see what's going on.
Yeah. And in the book, I learned about something I didn't know, which was the LinkedIn Social Selling Index. So if you go to linkedin.com/sales/SSI, and I'll include a link to it on this episode's website page, but it'll tell you how you're looking from a sales standpoint, and it'll give you a grade. You can do it. Really. Pause this interview. No, I'm kidding. Do it after this interview. But I thought that was great. And Julie, you said you were surprised I didn't know that. But hey, that's why I keep reading these books.
Yeah, it's a good way of checking where you are, because it looks at different aspects of your profile. And depending on what type of role you've got within an organization, you probably want to have slightly higher in certain areas than others. Some of them are around about how well you're finding, connections and things. And one of the areas is about how well you're building relationships. So, depending on what you're trying to do, you'd expect to see sort of a variance in those different areas. But when I've been working with sales teams that haven't really used social selling before, one of the best measurements to give them is just say, well, take a look at your SSI, and then don't measure yourself on how many posts you're doing or, how many people have liked what you've done. Actually, just try and improve your SSI over time.
Yes.
And if you're working in a, using the LinkedIn in a way that's effective, your SSI will go up. And perhaps you notice that relationship building isn't a great strength, and that's what you really want to be doing. Well, what more could I be doing in that area? Because you don't really have to have enormous reach. You have to have connections that you're building relationships with who are likely to buy from you. And so, this obsession with always having the most people seeing your content or the most people liking your content isn't, yeah, that might be great for, for your ego, but it might not necessarily translate into sales. Those relationships will translate into sales.
A couple of the things I wanted to ask you about, and again, this one I think might surprise people that it's in this book on social selling, but it's chapter 8, and it's about storytelling. And I want to quote from page 186, where you write, effective communication is fundamentally about finding the information that will resonate with your intended audience. Of course, knowing your buyer's needs, preferences, and priorities is critical in almost every aspect of social selling. But unless your content engages them, all that knowledge, research, and investment in content creation falls straight into the gap that exists between your organization and your customers. But building a bridge between you both is straightforward, albeit shockingly more esoteric and intangible than data, technical know-how, or product knowledge could ever be. That bridge depends on your ability to fulfill the oldest and most fundamental requirement of humanity, the quest for meaning. And you go on to write, this might sound a bit grandiose if all you're trying to do is increase sales of your client's brand of air conditioning units, but ever since the beginning of human development, we have been hardwired to look for a narrative thread in everything we see or experience. And then finally, you lower down that page, you write, we are by nature storytellers. And that's why assuming your buyer only wants to know the facts about your air conditioning equipment is a mistake. How are B2B companies using storytelling effectively then?
Well, I think it's the same as with everything, really, with B2C and B2B. But if we just talk about the products and services that we have, we are in the same space as all of our competitors because they pretty much sell the same products and services that we sell. And that's very dull. It's very hard for us to have any kind of standout. And also, it's very hard for anyone to make an emotional connection with us as an individual or our brand, our business. And so, but if we can think about what we bring as an organization, what we stand for, what's interesting about us and unique about us, that's important to us and also to our buyers, then we've actually got an opportunity to make a much deeper connection. And I think, goes on into this chapter to talk about the seven basic plots that exist in storytelling.
Yes, from Christopher Booker's book.
Yeah, and I think that that does give people who perhaps don't feel very confident about writing and engaging with people via social a way of framing the context of how they want to talk about their business or about their brand or about themselves. And that holds together that narrative for them. So if you've got an idea of, well, you know, what is the story I'm trying to tell about what we're doing here and why we're doing it and how we're doing it and who's involved in it, and you've got different characters and different people who are supporting that story and that experience, then actually you can see yourself in there. Well, who am I? You know, what role do I play? Does my personal brand play alongside these other characters, these other personal brands and our organization within this narrative we're trying to tell? Because we want to be interesting over the long term. We're not just trying to make a sale for tomorrow. We're trying to build a relationship that's going to last years and people come back to us and we'll help them shape the next stage of their journey. And we do that by being interesting and meaningful. And we can't really do that if we just talk about products and services.
Mm, yes. Just a couple of the quick questions. You have an entire chapter on monitoring and measurement of B2B social selling. And I found it interesting when you write that there's a disconnect between the way salespeople are traditionally measured and targeted on monthly and quarterly sales versus the way you should be measuring social selling. But back to the chapter title, the chapter is monitoring and measurement. Explain why it's important to understand the difference between monitoring and measurement and why you need to do both.
So I think the measurement is, you know, have we achieved what we set out to do, and do the results? You know, we said we were going to spend this amount of money and in order to achieve this return, and did we get there? So the measurement is kind of those lines in the sand where you stop and you make sure that you have actually achieved what you set out to do. But in B2B, that can be like quite a long time before you know whether that's happened or not. So there needs to be some kind of monitoring that goes along in the first instance. And that might be, you know, indicator kind of KPIs, which tell us that we're on track, you know, that the really obvious one is how many leads are we getting in, which, you know, ultimately we might know what our conversion rate is, and therefore we'll know how many sales we're going to get at the end. So if not driving those leads, we're never going to get to those sales. But I think in social selling, we want to change behavior. Often we're going through a process of behavior change within an organization mm-hmm. in order for people to start doing this well. And so we don't really want to measure how much revenue they've brought in immediately. We want to see how is that behavior changing and monitor, you know, and that's why SSI can be really useful in mm-hmm. LinkedIn, to see not necessarily that I've brought in a certain amount of sales, but actually I've changed their behavior on LinkedIn and got my SSI up from 20 to 50 and hopefully eventually to the magic 70, which seems to indicate, you know, that you've got a level of activity that's working really positively, and you're much more likely to be a really effective salesperson on LinkedIn. So that, you know, these are the kind of things that we want to track and check, I suppose. And I think it's interesting in the research that's in the book, which looked at, you know, interviewing and researching sales team, and they were really clear about it, having modeled behavior by leadership, mm-hmm. knowing what they were supposed to be doing, not necessarily how much they needed to make in order to be effective. And that's what we want to look for. We want to be monitoring that behavior, monitoring the funnel, I suppose, as well, because it'll give us much more insight than, you know, ahead of when we're eventually able to measure the sales at the end.
Yes, it reminds me of the expression I've heard, actions lead to transactions, where obviously you want to measure the transactions and some of those other metrics, but also is the activity taking place that will ultimately lead to that? And just so folks know, just so the CEOs listening, there is a little bit of math in that chapter. So it's all there. It's all there. You can measure that. And the last thing is that you talk about management buy-in. The final chapter, it's about the culture, and you write that for many organizations, social media is still a bolt-on to their core business activities, and it may even only be considered purely as a media channel. In your experience, what is it that gets an organization to start to transform their sales culture to embracing the social selling mindset?
So I think you either need a leader who identifies that this is there's a real opportunity here. Somebody like Marlene Leiden at SAP, you know, she kind of really led that through her organization and tested it within a division to prove that it would work, and then rolled it out across the organization. So you might need somebody like that. It may come from a bottom-up process. So, mm-hmm. yeah, somebody in the team is really, really good at it, and the rest of the team are looking at them thinking, wow, this, you know, something's going on here.
I want some of that.
What can I do? How can I be better at this? And the other way, and the reason I actually wrote the book, was during lockdown, and suddenly all these sales teams couldn't get on the road. And when they were ringing people in their office, nobody was in their office because they were all working from home. And their whole kind of sales process really kind of broke down. And organizations I've been working with from a marketing perspective were coming to me and saying, God, we've got all these salespeople and we really think we need to be using social media, but none of them know how to use it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how do we bring their confidence in these channels up to speed? Because up to now they probably didn't need them, but actually, as we're in a much more hybrid working situation, and also people's expectations have changed about whether they're going to have meetings and all of these kind of things, the power of these channels has just increased.
Yes, and the research, it was by Gallagher who did the research you fielded for this book. And I found that interesting. He highlighted three areas which, if addressed, could significantly improve the sales team's adoption of and performance in personal branding activities. And one was lack of confidence holding them back. And a good reason to do it is essential, In other words, they want evidence that this is going to they're going to help them. And then the third one was a company-wide commitment is the game changer. And I just didn't see how it's going to be possible if there's not management buy-in. But the last thing I want to ask you about is that for the listener who's working for an organization that's still, you know, to that person thinks they're in the Stone Age, even an individual seller could start to do some of these things on their own without asking permission, obviously not breaking any rules. But it seems like that could be a great way for them to maybe start to increase their sales, but also help their organization say, what are you doing? And if it doesn't work out, you're already on the right track for your next sales job at a different company.
Yeah. And in a way, that's what's that Sean Gallagher, who did the research, he's a sales guy in the tech industry, and he's really successful, and he uses social selling. And he was evangelical about it within his team and wanted to encourage his organization to go down that route. So part of his, for his master's, he did this research as part of his master's. And I think that, you know, really great salespeople are looking for those opportunities where they've got at the edge, aren't they? They don't want to just be chasing the same thing that all their competitors are doing. They want that edge. And this is a way for them to grow their own personal brand, grow their own reputation within the industry, alongside being way better at sales than they were before. And so it's kind of a no-brainer for them.
Yeah, what's not to love?
Yeah, it is a no-brainer. And it is surprising how many of them are very nervous of doing it, you know. And that's why I wrote the book, really, to say, there's a blueprint in here that you can follow. You can take your own process. You can look at your own SSR. You control your own social channels. They don't belong to your organization. They belong to you. And therefore, think really carefully about what your personal brand is going to be. And don't just share and like content that your company, you know, is putting out on its marketing channels. Actually, go back to them and talk about how the type of content that you would really like to be sharing, because it would be really effective with your customers, but also will support your building that expertise in your own thought leadership and personal brand. And that's where you're going to have a real edge. And it's not going to happen, you know, without all the other sales channels that you're using. It's not going to happen without your skill as a salesperson, but it is really going to enhance your personal visibility and reputation and you know, results as a, you know, everyone who uses it sees that's what happens.
Well, Julie Atherton, if readers took only one thing away from the book, that sounds like that would be it.
Yeah,
would you agree?
Yeah. I think so. Just have a go and, you know, start like you did. Just have a little look at your SSI and what you're doing well and what you're not doing well. And just have a go at it, because it isn't actually that hard. It's just you need to be more really focused on what you talk about.
And the secret of getting ahead is getting started. And that is one thing a listener could do today, is check out their SSI on LinkedIn.
Absolutely.
Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, like I said, we're going to include links to everything linkable, the books that have been mentioned, your site, your LinkedIn profile. Folks, please reach out to Julie and congratulate her on the book. Thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast so quickly. If nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn. Let us know what you thought of it, what you learned. Tag us so we can thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone, you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app. All these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is B2B Social Selling Strategy: Connect with Customers, Build Relationships, and Drive Sales. The author is Julie Atherton. Julie, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, baby!